You're listening to part 2 of episode 611 of Unwelcome Guests. We continue with a reading from David Graeber's Debt, the first 5,000 years, picking up where we left off last episode in chapter 10.
The Middle Ages were marked by a general move toward abstraction. Real gold and silver ended up largely in churches, monasteries, and temples. Money became virtual again. And at the same time, the tendency everywhere was to set up overarching moral institutions meant to regulate the process, and in particular, to establish certain protections for debtors. China was unusual in that it was the one place where an Axial Age empire managed to survive, though at first only barely. Chinese governments did manage to keep coins in circulation in most places most of the time. This was made easier by their reliance exclusively on small denomination coins made of bronze. Even so, it clearly took enormous efforts. As usual, we don't know a lot about how everyday economic transactions took place, but what we do know suggests that in small-scale transactions, coins were probably most often used in dealing with strangers. As elsewhere, local shopkeepers and merchants extended credit. Most accounts seem to have been kept through the use of tally sticks, strikingly similar to those used in England, except that rather than hazelwood, they were usually made of a split piece of notched bamboo. Here too, the creditor took one half and the debtor took the other. They were joined at the moment of repayment, and often broken afterward to mark the cancellation of the debt. To what degree were they transferable? We don't really know. Most of what we do know is from casual references in texts that are mainly about something else. Anecdotes, jokes, and poetic allusions. The great collection of Taoist wisdom. The Lai Tzu, probably written during the Han Dynasty, contains one such. Quote, "There was a man of Sung who was strolling in the street and picked up a half tally someone had lost. He took it home and stored it away, and secretly counted the indentations of the broken edge. He told a neighbour, 'I shall be rich any day now.'" Unquote. Rather like someone who finds a key and figures, "Just as soon as I can figure out which lock." Another story tells of how Liu Bang, a bibulous local constable and future founder of the Han Dynasty, used to go on all-night drinking binges, running up enormous tabs. Once, while he lay collapsed in a drunken stupor in a wine shop, the owner saw a dragon hovering over his head, a sure sign of future greatness, and immediately broke the tally, forgiving him his accumulated drinking debts. Tallies weren't just used for loans, but for any sort of contract, which is why early paper contracts also had to be cut in half, and one half kept by either party. With paper contracts, there was a definite tendency for the creditor's half to function as an IOU and thus become transferable. By 806 AD, for instance, right around the apogee of Chinese Buddhism, merchants moving tea over long distances from the far south of the country and officials transporting tax payments to the capital, all of them concerned with the dangers of carrying bullion over long distances, began to deposit their money with bankers in the capital and devised a system of promissory notes. They were called flying cash. Also divided in half, like tallies, and redeemable for cash, in their branches in the provinces. They quickly started passing from hand to hand, and operated something like currency. The government first tried to forbid their use, then, a year or two later, and this became a familiar pattern in China, when it realized that it could not suppress them, switched gears and established a bureau empowered to issue such notes themselves. By the early Song Dynasty, 960 to 1279 AD, local banking operations all over China were running similar operations, accepting cash and bullion for safekeeping, and allowing depositors to use their receipts as promissory notes, as well as trading in government coupons for salt and tea. Many of these notes came to circulate as de facto money. The government, as usual, first tried to ban the practice, then control it, granting a monopoly to 16 leading merchants. Then, finally, set up a government monopoly, the Bureau of Exchange Medium, established in 1023, and before long, aided by the newly invented printing press, was operating factories in several cities, employing thousands of workers, and producing literally millions of notes. At first, this paper money was meant to circulate for a limited time. Notes would expire after 2, then 3, then 7 years, and was redeemable in bullion. Over time, especially as the Song came under increasing military pressure, the temptation to simply print money with little or no backup became overwhelming. And, moreover, Chinese governments were rarely completely willing to accept their own paper money for tax purposes. Combine this with the fact that the bills were worthless outside China, and it's rather surprising that the system worked at all. Certainly, inflation was a constant problem, and the money would have to be recalled and reissued. Occasionally, the whole system would break down, but then people would resort to their own expedients, privately issued tea checks, noodle checks, bamboo tallies, wine tallies, etc. Still, the Mongols, who ruled China from 1271 to 1368 AD, chose to maintain the system, and it was only abandoned in the 17th century. This is important to note, because a conventional account tends to represent China's experiment with paper money as a failure. Even, for the metallists, proof that fiat money, backed only by state power, will always eventually collapse. This is especially odd, since the centuries when paper money was in use are usually considered the most economically dynamic in Chinese history. Surely, if the United States government was eventually forced to abandon the use of Federal Reserve notes in 2400 AD, no one would be arguing that this showed that the very idea was always intrinsically unworkable. Nonetheless, the main point I'd like to emphasize here is that terms like fiat money, however common, are deceptive. Almost all of the new forms of paper money that emerged were not originally created by governments at all. They were simply ways of recognizing and expanding the use of credit instruments that emerged from everyday economic transactions. If it was only China that developed paper money in the Middle Ages, this was largely because only in China was there a government large and powerful enough, but also sufficiently suspicious of its mercantile classes, to feel it had to take charge of such operations. The Near West. Islam. Capital as credit. The section begins with a quote attributed to the Prophet Muhammad, "Prices depend on the will of Allah. It is He who raises and lowers them." And with an Islamic legal precept, the profit of each partner must be in proportion to the share of each in the adventure. For most of the Middle Ages, the economic nerve centre of the world economy and source of its most dramatic financial innovations was neither China nor India, but the West, which, from the perspective of the rest of the world, meant the world of Islam. During most of this period, Christendom, lodged in the declining empire of Byzantium and the obscure semi-barbarous principalities of Europe, was largely insignificant. Since people who live in Western Europe have so long been in the habit of thinking of Islam as the very definition of the East, it's easy to forget that from the perspective of any other great tradition, the difference between Christianity and Islam is almost negligible. One need only pick up a book on, say, medieval Islamic philosophy to discover disputes between the Baghdad Aristotelians and the Neo-Pythagoreans in Basra, or Persian Neoplatonists, essentially, scholars doing the same work of trying to square the revealed religious traditions, beginning with Abraham and Moses, with the categories of Greek philosophy, and doing so in a larger context of mercantile capitalism, universalistic missionary religion, scientific rationalism, poetic celebrations of romantic love, and periodic waves of fascination with mystical wisdom from the East. From a world historical perspective, it seems much more sensible to see Judaism, Christianity, and Islam as three different manifestations of the same great Western intellectual tradition, which, for most of human history, has centered on Mesopotamia and the Levant, extending into Egypt as far as Greece and into Africa as far as Egypt, and sometimes farther west across the Mediterranean or down the Nile. Economically, most of Europe was, until perhaps the High Middle Ages, in exactly the same situation as most of Africa, plugged into the larger world economy, if at all, largely as an exporter of slaves, raw materials, and the occasional exotica, amber elephant tusks, and an importer of manufactured goods, Chinese silks and porcelain, Indian calicos, Arab steel. To get a sense of the comparative economic development, even if the examples are somewhat scattered over time, consider the following table of populations and tax revenues from 350 BC to 1200 AD. I'm not going to read the table out, but it compares different empires over time in terms of population, revenue expressed as tons of silver, and revenue per head in terms of grams of silver. Just to pick one statistic out of the table, revenue per head is an order of magnitude more for the ancient empires than it was in France or England in the 13th century. What's more, for most of the Middle Ages, Islam was not only the core of Western civilization, it was its expansive edge, working its way into India, expanding into Africa and Europe, sending missionaries and winning converts across the Indian Ocean. The prevailing Islamic attitude toward law, government, and economic matters was the exact opposite of that prevalent in China. Confucians were suspicious of governance through strict codes of law, preferring to rely on the inherent sense of justice of the cultivated scholar, a scholar who was simply assumed to be a government official. Medieval Islam, on the other hand, enthusiastically embraced law, which was seen as a religious institution, derived from the Prophet, but tended to view government, more often than not, as an unfortunate necessity, an institution that the truly pious would do better to avoid. In part, this was because of the peculiar nature of Islamic government. The Arab military leaders, who, after Muhammad's death in 632 AD, conquered the Sasanian Empire and established the Abbasid Caliphate, always continued to see themselves as people of the desert, and never felt entirely part of the urban civilizations they had come to rule. This discomfort was never quite overcome on either side. It took the bulk of the population several centuries to convert to the conqueror's religion, and even when they did, they never seemed to have really identified with their rulers. Government was seen as military power, necessary perhaps, to defend the faith, but fundamentally exterior to society. In part, too, it was because of the peculiar alliance between merchants and common folk that came to be aligned against them. After Caliph al-Ma'mun's abortive attempt to set up a theocracy in 832 AD, the government took a hands-off position on questions of religion. The various schools of Islamic law were free to create their own educational institutions and maintain their own separate system of religious justice. Crucially, it was the ulema, the legal scholars, who were the principled agents in the conversion of the bulk of the empire's population to Islam in Mesopotamia, Syria, Egypt, and North Africa, in those same years. But, like the elders in charge of the guilds, civic associations, commercial sodalities, and religious brotherhoods, they did their best to keep the government, with its armies and ostentation, at arm's length. "The best princes are those who visit religious teachers," one proverb put it. "The worst religious teachers are those who allow themselves to be visited by princes." A medieval Turkish story brings it home even more pointedly. Quote, "The king once summoned Nasruddin to court. 'Tell me,' said the king, 'you are a mystic, a philosopher, a man of unconventional understandings. I have become interested in the issue of value. It's an interesting philosophical question. How does one establish the true worth of a person or an object? Take me, for example. If I were to ask you to estimate my value, what would you say?' 'Oh,' Nasruddin said, 'I'd say about 200 dinars.' The emperor was flabbergasted. 'What? But this belt I'm wearing is worth 200 dinars.' 'I know,' said Nasruddin. 'Actually, I was taking the value of the belt into consideration.'" Unquote. This disjuncture had profound economic effects. It meant that the Caliphate, and later Muslim empires, could operate in many ways much like the old Axial Age empires, creating professional armies, waging wars of conquest, capturing slaves, melting down loot and distributing it in the form of coins to soldiers and officials, demanding that those coins be rendered back as taxes, but, at the same time, without having nearly the same effects on ordinary people's lives. Over the course of the Wars of Expansion, for example, enormous quantities of gold and silver were indeed looted from palaces, temples, and monasteries and stamped into coinage, allowing the Caliphate to produce gold dinars and silver dirhams of remarkable purity. That is, with next to no fiduciary element, the value of each coin corresponding almost precisely to its weight in precious metal. As a result, they were able to pay their troops extraordinarily well. A soldier in the Caliph's army, for example, received almost four times the wages once received by a Roman legionary. We can perhaps speak of a kind of military coinage slavery complex here, but it existed in a kind of bubble. Wars of expansion and trade with Europe and Africa did produce a fairly constant flow of slaves, but, in dramatic contrast to the ancient world, very few of them ended up labouring in farms or workshops. Most ended up as decoration in the houses of the rich, or, increasingly over time, as soldiers. Over the course of the Abbasid dynasty, 750 to 1258 AD, in fact, the empire came to rely for its military forces almost exclusively on Mamluks, highly trained military slaves captured or purchased from the Turkish steppes. The policy of employing slaves as soldiers was maintained by all of the Islamic successor states, including the Mughals, and culminated in the famous Mamluk Sultanate in Egypt in the 13th century, but, historically, it was unprecedented. In most times and places, slaves are, for obvious reasons, the very last people to be allowed anywhere near weapons. Here it was systematic, but in a strange way, it also made perfect sense. If slaves are, by definition, people who have been severed from society, this was the logical consequence of the wall created between society and the medieval Islamic state. Religious teachers appear to have done everything they could do to prop up the wall. One reason for the recourse to slave soldiers was their tendency to discourage the faithful from serving in the military, since it might mean fighting fellow believers. The legal system that they created also ensured that it was effectively impossible for Muslims, or for that matter Christian or Jewish subjects of the Caliphate, to be reduced to slavery. Here Al-Wahid seems to have been largely correct. Islamic law took aim at just about all the most notorious abuses of earlier Axial Age societies. Slavery through kidnapping, judicial punishment, debt, and the exposure or sale of children, even through the voluntary sale of one's own person, all were forbidden or rendered unenforceable. Likewise, with all the other forms of debt peonage that had loomed over the heads of poor Middle Eastern farmers and their families since the dawn of recorded history. Finally, Islam strictly forbade usury, which it interpreted to mean any arrangement in which money or a commodity was lent at interest for any purpose whatsoever. In a way, one can see the establishment of Islamic courts as the ultimate triumph of the patriarchal rebellion that had begun so many thousands of years before, of the ethos of the desert or the steppe, real or imagined, even as the faithful did their best to keep the heavily armed descendants of actual nomads confined to their camps and palaces. It was made possible by a profound shift in class alliances. The great urban civilizations of the Middle East had always been dominated by a de facto alliance between administrators and merchants, both of whom kept the rest of the population either in debt peonage or in constant peril of falling into it. In converting to Islam, the commercial classes, so long the arch-villains in the eyes of ordinary farmers and townsfolk, effectively agreed to change sides, abandon all their most hated principles, and become instead the leaders of a society that now defined itself against the state. It was possible because from the beginning Islam had a positive view toward commerce. Muhammad himself had begun his adult life as a merchant, and no Islamic thinker ever treated the honest pursuit of profit as itself intrinsically immoral or inimical to faith. Neither did the prohibitions against usury, which for the most part were scrupulously enforced, even in the case of commercial loans, in any sense, mitigate against the growth of commerce, or even the development of complex credit instruments. To the contrary, the early centuries of the Caliphate saw an immediate efflorescence in both. Profits were still possible because Islamic jurists were careful to allow for certain service fees and other considerations, notably allowing goods bought on credit to be priced slightly higher than those bought for cash. That ensured that bankers and traders still had an incentive to provide credit services. Still, these incentives were never enough to allow the banking to become a full-time occupation. Instead, almost any merchant operating on a sufficiently large scale could be expected to combine banking with a host of other money-making activities. As a result, credit instruments soon became so essential to trade that almost anyone of prominence was expected to keep most of his or her wealth on deposit, and to make everyday transactions not by counting out coins, but by ink pot and paper. Promissory notes were called sak, checks, or rukka, notes. Checks could bounce. One German historian, picking through a multitude of old Arabic literary sources, recounts that, quote, about 900 AD, a great man paid a poet in this way, only the banker refused the check, so that the disappointed poet composed a verse to the effect that he would gladly pay a million on the same plan. A patron of the same poet and the singer, at 936, during a concert, wrote a check in his favour on a banker, 500 dinars. When paying, the banker gave the poet to understand that it was customary to charge 1 dirham discount on each dinar, i.e. about 10%. Only if the poet would spend the afternoon and evening with him, he would make no deduction. By about 1,000, the banker had made himself indispensable in Basra. Every trader had his banking account, and paid only in checks on his bank in the bazaar. Unquote. Checks could be countersigned and transferred, and letters of credit, suftaja, could travel across the Indian Ocean or the Sahara. If they did not turn into de facto paper money, it was because, since they operated completely independent of the state, they couldn't be used to pay taxes, for instance, their value was based almost entirely on trust and reputation. Appeal to the Islamic courts was generally voluntary or mediated by merchant guilds and civic associations. In such a context, having a famous poet compose verses making fun of you for bouncing a check was probably the ultimate disaster. When it came to finance, instead of interest-bearing investments, the preferred approach was partnerships, where, often, one party would supply the capital, the other carry out the enterprise. Instead of fixed return, the investor would receive a share of the profits. Even labour arrangements were often organised on a profit-sharing basis. In all such matters, reputation was crucial. In fact, one lively debate in early commercial law was over the question of whether reputation could, like land, labour, money, or other resources, itself be considered a form of capital. It sometimes happened that merchants would form partnerships with no capital at all, but only their good names. This was called partnership of good reputation. As one legal scholar explained, quote, as for the credit partnership, it is also called the partnership of the penniless, Shariqa al-Mafalis. It comes about when two people form a partnership without any capital in order to buy on credit and then sell. It is designated by this name, partnership of good reputations, because their capital consists of their status and good reputations. For credit is extended only to him who has a good reputation among people. Unquote. Some legal scholars objected to the idea that such a contract could be considered legally binding, since it was not based on an initial outlay of material capital. Others considered it legitimate, provided the partners make an equitable partition of the profits, since reputation cannot be quantified. The remarkable thing here is the tacit recognition that, in a credit economy that operates largely without state mechanisms of enforcement, without police to arrest those who commit fraud or bailiffs to seize a debtor's property, a significant part of the value of a promissory note is indeed the good name of the signatory. As Pierre Bourdieu was later to point out in describing a similar economy of trust in contemporary Algeria, it's quite possible to turn honour into money, almost impossible to convert money into honour. These networks of trust, in turn, were largely responsible for the spread of Islam over the caravan routes of Central Asia and the Sahara, and especially across the Indian Ocean, the main conduit of medieval world trade. Over the course of the Middle Ages, the Indian Ocean effectively became a Muslim lake. Muslim traders appear to have played a key role in establishing the principle that kings and their armies should keep their quarrels on dry land, and the seas were to be a zone of peaceful commerce. At the same time, Islam gained a toehold in trade emporia from Aden to the Moluccas, because Islamic courts were so perfectly suited to provide those functions that made such ports attractive, means of establishing contracts, recovering debts, creating a banking sector capable of redeeming or transferring letters of credit. The level of trust thereby created between merchants in the great Malay entrepôt, Malacca, gateway to the Spice Islands of Indonesia, was legendary. The city had Swahili, Arab, Egyptian, Ethiopian, and Armenian quarters, as well as quarters for merchants from different regions of India, China, and Southeast Asia. Yet, it was said that its merchants shunned enforceable contracts, preferring to seal transactions with a handshake and a glance at heaven. In Islamic society, the merchant became not just a respected figure, but a kind of paragon. Like the warrior, a man of honour able to pursue far-flung adventures. Unlike him, able to do so in a fashion damaging to no one. The French historian Maurice Lombard draws a striking, if perhaps rather idealized, picture of him. Quote, "In his stately townhouse, surrounded by slaves and hangers-on, in the midst of his collection of books, travel souvenirs, and rare ornaments," unquote, along with his ledgers, correspondence, and letters of credit, skilled in the arts of double-entry bookkeeping, along with secret codes and ciphers, giving alms to the poor, supporting places of worship, perhaps dedicating himself to the writing of poetry, while still able to translate his general creditworthiness into great capital reserves by appealing to family and partners. Lombard's picture is to some degree inspired by the famous Thousand and One Nights description of Sinbad, who, having spent his youth in perilous mercantile ventures to faraway lands, finally retired, rich beyond dreams, to spend the rest of his life amidst gardens and dancing girls, telling tall tales of his adventures. Here's a glimpse from the eyes of a humble porter, also named Sinbad, when first summoned to see him by the master's page. Quote, "He found it to be a goodly mansion, radiant and full of majesty, till he brought him to a grand sitting-room, wherein he saw a company of nobles and great lords seated at tables, garnished with all manner of flowers and sweet-scented herbs, besides great plenty of dainty viands and fruits dried and fresh, and confections and wines of the choicest vintages. There also were instruments of music and mirth, and lovely slave-girls playing and singing. All the company was ranged according to rank, and in the highest place sat a man of worshipful and noble aspect, whose bearded sides hoariness had stricken, and he was stately of stature and fair of favour, agreeable of aspect, and full of gravity and dignity and majesty. So Sinbad the porter was confounded at that which he beheld, and said by himself, 'By Allah, this must be some king's place, or a piece of paradise.'" Unquote. It's worth quoting not only because it represents a certain ideal, a picture of the perfect life, but because there's no real Christian parallel. It would be impossible to conceive of such an image appearing in, say, a medieval French romance. The veneration of the merchant was matched by what can only be called the world's first popular free market ideology. True, one should be careful not to confuse ideals with reality. Markets were never entirely independent from government. Islamic regimes did employ all the usual strategies of manipulating tax policy to encourage the growth of markets, and they periodically tried to intervene in commercial law. Still, there was a very strong popular feeling that they shouldn't. Once freed from its ancient scourges of debt and slavery, the local bazaar had become, for most, not a place of moral danger, but the very opposite, the highest expression of the human freedom and communal solidarity, and thus to be protected assiduously from state intrusion. There was particular hostility to anything that smacked of price-fixing. One much-repeated story held that the Prophet himself had refused to force merchants to lower prices during a shortage in the city of Medina, on the grounds that doing so would be sacrilegious, since, in a free market situation, prices depend on the will of God. Most legal scholars interpreted Muhammad's decision to mean that any government interference in market mechanisms should be considered similarly sacrilegious, since markets were designed by God to regulate themselves. If all this bears a striking resemblance to Adam Smith's invisible hand, which was also the hand of divine providence, it might not be a complete coincidence. In fact, many of the specific arguments and examples that Smith uses appear to trace back directly to economic tracts written in medieval Persia. For instance, not only does his argument that exchange is a natural outgrowth of human rationality and speech already appear in both the Ghazali, 1058-1111 AD, and Tushi, 1201-1274 AD, both use exactly the same illustration, that no one has ever observed two dogs exchanging bones. Even more dramatically, Smith's most famous example of division of labour, the pin factory, where it takes 18 separate operations to produce one pin, already appears in Ghazali's Ihya, in which he describes a needle factory where it takes 25 different operations to produce a needle. The differences, however, are just as telling as the similarities. One telling example, like Smith, Tushi begins his treatise on economics with a discussion of the division of labour. But where for Smith the division of labour is actually an outgrowth of our natural propensity to truck and barter in pursuit of individual advantage, for Tushi it was an extension of mutual aid. Let's suppose that each individual were required to busy himself with providing his own sustenance, clothing, dwelling place, and weapons, first acquiring the tools of carpentry and the smith's trade, then readying thereby tools and implements for sowing and reaping, grinding and kneading, spinning and weaving. Clearly, he would not be capable of doing justice to any one of them. But, when men render aid to each other, each one performing one of these important tasks that are beyond the measure of his own capacity, and observing the law of justice in transactions by giving greatly and receiving in exchange of the labour of others, then the means of livelihood are realised, and the succession of the individual and the survival of the species are assured. Unquote. As a result, he argues, divine providence has arranged us to have different abilities, desires, and inclinations. The market is simply one manifestation of this more general principle of mutual aid, of the matching of abilities, supply, and needs, demand. Or, to translate it into my own earlier terms, it is not only founded on, but is itself an extension of, the kind of baseline communism on which any society must ultimately rest. All this is not to say that Tushi was, in any sense, a radical egalitarian. Quite the contrary. If men were not equal, he insists, they would all perish. We need differences between rich and poor, he insisted, just as much as we need differences between farmers and carpenters. Still, once you start from the initial premise that markets are primarily about cooperation rather than competition, and while Muslim economic thinkers did recognize and accept the need for market competition, they never saw competition as its essence, the moral implications are very different. Nasruddin's story about the quail eggs might have been a joke, but Muslim ethicists did often enjoin merchants to drive a hard bargain with the rich so that they could charge less or pay more when dealing with the less fortunate. Ghazali's take on the division of labour is similar, and his account of the origins of money is, if anything, even more revealing. It begins with what looks much like the myth of barter, except that, like all Middle Eastern writers, he starts not with imaginative primitive tribesmen, but with strangers meeting in an imaginary marketplace. Quote, "Sometimes a person needs what he does not own, and he owns what he does not need. For example, a person has saffron, but needs a camel for transportation, and one who owns a camel does not presently need that camel, but wants saffron. Thus, there is the need for an exchange. However, for there to be an exchange, there must be a way to measure the two objects, for the camel owner cannot give the whole camel for a quantity of saffron. There's no similarity between saffron and camel so that equal amount of that weight and form can be given. Likewise is the case of the one who desires a house, but owns some cloth, or desires a slave, but owns socks, or desires flour, but possesses a donkey. These goods have no direct proportionality, so one cannot know how much saffron will equal a camel's worth. Such barter transactions would be very difficult. Unquote. Ghazali also notes that there might also be a problem of one person not even needing what the other person has to offer, but this is almost an afterthought. For him, the real problem is conceptual. How do you compare two things with no common qualities? His conclusion: it can only be done by comparing both to a third thing with no qualities at all. For this reason, he explains, God created dinars and dirhams, coins made out of gold and silver, two metals that are otherwise no good for anything. Quote, dirhams and dinars are not created for any particular purpose. They're useless by themselves. They're just like stones. They're created to circulate from hand to hand, to govern and to facilitate transactions. They're symbols to know the value and grades of goods. Unquote. They can be symbols, units of measure, because of this very lack of usefulness, indeed lack of any particular feature other than value. Quote, a thing can only be exactly linked to other things if it has no particular special form or feature of its own. For example, a mirror that has no colour can reflect all colours. The same is the case with money. It has no purpose of its own, but it serves as a medium for the purpose of exchanging goods. Unquote. From this it also follows that lending money at interest must be illegitimate, since it means using money as an end in itself. Money is not created to earn money. In fact, he says, in relation to other goods, dirhams and dinars are like prepositions in a sentence, words that, as grammarians inform us, are used to give meaning to other words, but can only do so because they have no meaning in themselves. Money is thus a unit of measure that provides a means of assessing the value of goods, but also one that operates as such only if it stays in constant motion. To enter into monetary transactions in order to obtain even more money, even if it's a matter of M-C-M star, let alone M-M star, would be, according to Ghazali, the equivalent of kidnapping a postman. Whereas Ghazali speaks only of gold and silver, what he describes, money as symbol, as abstract measure, having no qualities of its own, whose value is only maintained by constant motion, is something that would never have occurred to anyone were it not in an age when it was perfectly normal for money to be employed in purely virtual form. Much of our free market doctrine, then, appears to have been originally borrowed piecemeal from a very different social and moral universe. The mercantile classes of the medieval Near West had pulled off an extraordinary feat. By abandoning the usurious practices that had made them so obnoxious to their neighbours for untold centuries before, they were able to become, alongside religious teachers, the effective leaders of their communities, communities that are still seen as organised to a large extent around the twin poles of mosque and bazaar. The spread of Islam allowed the market to become a global phenomenon, operating largely independent of governments, according to its own internal laws. But the very fact that this was, in a certain way, a genuine free market, not one created by the government and backed by its police and prisons, a world of handshake deals and paper promises backed only by the integrity of the signer, meant that it could never really become the world as imagined by those who later adopted many of the same ideas and arguments, one of purely self-interested individuals vying for material advantage by any means at hand. The Far West. Christendom. Commerce, Lending, and War. Begins with a quote from St. Ambrose, who said, "Where there is justice in war, there is also justice in usury." Europe, as I mentioned, came rather late into the Middle Ages, and for most of it was something of a hinterland. Still, the period began, much as it did elsewhere, with the disappearance of coinage. Money retreated into virtuality. Everyone continued to calculate costs in Roman currency, then later in Carolingian imaginary money, the purely conceptual system of pounds, shillings and pence used across Western Europe to keep accounts well into the 17th century. The local mints did gradually come back into operation, producing coins in an endless variety of weight, purity and denominations. How these related to the pan-European system, though, was a matter of manipulation. Kings regularly issued decrees, revaluing their own coins in relation to the money of account, crying up the currency by, say, declaring that henceforth one of their AQs or escudos would no longer be worth a twelfth, but now an eighth of a shilling, thus effectively raising taxes, or crying down the value of their coins by doing the reverse, and thus effectively reducing their debts. The real gold or silver content of coins was endlessly readjusted, and currencies were frequently called in for re-minting. Meanwhile, most everyday transactions dispense with cash entirely, operating through tallies, tokens, ledgers, or transactions in kind. As a result, when the scholastics came to address such matters in the 13th century, they quickly adopted Aristotle's position that money was a mere social convention, that it was, basically, whatever human beings decided that it was. All of this fit the broader medieval pattern. Actual gold and silver, such of it as was still around, was increasingly laid up in sacred places. As centralized states disappeared, the regulation of markets was increasingly in the hands of the church. At first, the Catholic attitudes towards usury were just as harsh as the Muslim ones, and attitudes towards merchants considerably harsher. In the first case, they had little choice, as many biblical texts were quite explicit. Consider Exodus 22:25, quote, "If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest." Unquote. Both Psalms 15:5 and 54:12 and Prophets Jeremiah 9:6 and Nehemiah 5:11 were explicit in assigning usurers to death and hellfire. What's more, the early Christian fathers, who laid the foundation of church teachings on social issues in the waning years of the Roman Empire, were writing amidst the ancient world's last great debt crisis, one that was effectively in the process of destroying the empire's remaining free peasantry. While few were willing to condemn slavery, all condemned usury. Usury was seen above all as an assault on Christian charity, on Jesus' injunction to treat the poor as they would treat the Christ himself, giving without expectation of return and allowing the borrower to decide on recompense. Luke 6:34-35. In 365 AD, for instance, St. Basil delivered a sermon on usury in Cappadocia that set the standard for such issues. Quote, "The Lord gave his own injunction quite plainly in the words, 'From him that would borrow of thee, turn thou not away.' But what of the money-lover? He sees before him a man, under stress of necessity, bent to the ground in supplication. He sees him hesitating at no act, no words of humiliation. He sees him suffering undeserved misfortune. But he is merciless. He does not reckon that he is a fellow creature. He does not give in to his entreaties. He stands stiff and sour. He is moved by no prayers. His resolution is broken by no tears. He persists in refusal." Unquote. That is, until the suppliant mentions interest. Basil was particularly offended by the crass dishonesty by which moneylenders operated, their abuse of Christian fellowship. The man in need comes seeking a friend. The rich man pretends to be one. In fact, he's a secret enemy, and everything he says is a lie. Witness, St. Basil said, how the rich man will always at first swear mighty oaths that he has no money to his name. Quote, "Then the suppliant mentions interest and utters the word security. All is changed. The frown is relaxed. With a genial smile he recalls old family connection. Now it is my friend. I will see, says he, if I have any money by me. Yes, there is that sum which a man I know has left in my hands on deposit for profit. He stipulated a very heavy rate of interest, however. I shall certainly take something off and give it to you on better terms. With pretences of this kind and talk like this, he fawns on the wretched victim and induces him to swallow the bait. Then he binds him with a written security, adds loss of liberty to the trouble of his pressing poverty, and is off. The man who has made himself responsible for interest that he cannot pay has accepted voluntary slavery for life. Unquote. And the borrower, coming home with his newfound money, at first rejoices, but quickly the money slips away, interest accumulates, and his possessions are sold off. Basil grows poetic in describing the debtor's plight. It's as if time itself has become his enemy. Every day and night conspires against him, as they are parents of interest. His life becomes a sleepless days of anxious uncertainty, as he is humiliated in public. While at home, he is constantly hiding under the couch at every unexpected knock on the door. He can barely sleep, startled awake by nightmare visions of his creditor standing over his pillow. Probably the most famous ancient homily on usury, though, was St. Ambrose's De Turbia, pronounced over several days in Milan in 380 BC. He reproduces the same vivid details as Basil: fathers forced to sell their children, debtors who hanged themselves out of shame. Usury, he observes, must be considered a form of violent robbery, even murder. Ambrose, though, added one small proviso that was later to have enormous influence. His sermon was the first to carefully examine every biblical reference to money lending, which meant that he had to address the one problem later authors always had to struggle with: the fact that in the Old Testament usury is not quite forbidden to everyone. The key sticking point is always Deuteronomy chapter 23, verses 19 and 20. Quote, "Thou shalt not lend upon usury to thy brother, usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. Unto a stranger thou mayst lend upon usury, but unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon usury." Unquote. So who then is this stranger, or a better translation of the Hebrew nokri, foreigner? Presumably, one against whom robbery and murder would have been justified as well. After all, the ancient Jews lived amidst tribes like the Amalekites, on whom God had specifically instructed them to make war. If by extracting interest one is, as he puts it, fighting without a sword, then it's only legitimate to do so from those whom it would not be a crime to kill. For Ambrose, living in Milan, all this was something of a technicality. He included all Christians and all those subject to Roman law as brothers. There weren't, then, a lot of Amalekites around. Later, the exception of St. Ambrose, as it came to be known, was to become extremely important. All of these sermons, and there were many of them, left certain critical questions unanswered. What should the rich man do when receiving a visit from his troubled neighbour? True, Jesus had said to give without the expectation of return, but it seemed unrealistic to expect most Christians to do that. And even if they did, what sort of ongoing relationships would that create? St. Basil took the radical position. God had given us all things in common, and he'd specifically instructed the rich to give their possessions to the poor. The communism of the apostles, who pooled all their wealth and took freely what they needed, was thus the only proper model for a truly Christian society. Few of the other Christian fathers were willing to take things this far. Communism was the ideal, but in this fallen and temporary world, they argued, it was simply unrealistic. The church must accept existing property arrangements, but also come up with spiritual arguments to encourage the rich to nonetheless act with Christian charity. Many of these employed distinctly commercial metaphors. Even Basil was willing to indulge in this sort of thing. Quote, "Whenever you provide for the destitute on account of the Lord, it is both a gift and a loan. It is a gift because you entertain no hope in recovering it, a loan because of our Lord's munificence in paying you back on his behalf, when, having taken a small sum for the poor, he will give you back a vast sum in return. For he who takes pity on the poor lends to God." Unquote. Since Christ is in the poor, a vision of charity is a loan to Jesus, to be repaid with interest inconceivable on earth. Charity, however, is a way of maintaining hierarchy, not undermining it. What Basil is talking about here really has nothing to do with debt. and playing with such metaphors seems, ultimately, to serve only to underline the fact that the rich man doesn't owe the poor suppliant anything, any more than God is in any way legally bound to save the soul of anyone who feeds a beggar. Debt here dissolves into a pure hierarchy, hence the Lord, where utterly different beings provide each other utterly different kinds of benefit. Later theologians were to explicitly confirm this. Human beings live in time, noted St. Thomas Aquinas, so it makes sense to say that sin is a debt of punishment we owe to God. But God lives outside of time, by definition. He cannot owe anything to anyone. His grace can therefore only be a gift given with no obligation. Now this, in turn, provides an answer to the question, what are they really asking the rich man to do? The Church opposed usury, but it had little to say about relations of feudal dependency, where the rich man provides charity and the poor suppliant shows his gratitude in other ways. Neither, when these kinds of arrangements began to emerge across the Christian West, did the Church offer significant objections. Former debt peons were gradually transformed into serfs or vassals. In some ways, this relationship was not much different, since vassalage was, in theory, a voluntary contractual relationship. Just as a Christian has to be able to freely choose to submit himself to the Lord, so did a vassal have to agree to make himself someone else's man. All this proved perfectly consonant with Christianity. Commerce, on the other hand, remained a problem. There was not so much of a leap between condemning usury as the taking of whatever exceeds the amount loaned, and condemning any form of profit-taking. Many, St. Ambrose among them, were willing to take that leap. Where Mohammed declared that an honest merchant deserved a place by the seat of God in heaven, men like Ambrose wondered if an honest merchant could actually exist. Many held that one simply could not be both a merchant and a Christian. In the early Middle Ages, this was not a pressing issue, especially since so much commerce was conducted by foreigners. The conceptual problems, however, were never resolved. What did it mean that one could only lend to strangers? Was it just usury, or was even commerce tantamount to war? Probably the most notorious and often catastrophic way that this problem worked itself out in the High Middle Ages was in relations between Christians and Jews. In the years since Nehemiah, Jewish attitudes toward lending had themselves changed. In the time of Augustus, Rabbi Hillel had effectively rendered the sabbatical year a dead letter by allowing two parties to place a rider on any particular loan contract, agreeing that it would not apply. While both the Torah and the Talmud stood opposed to loans on interest, exceptions were made in dealing with Gentiles, particularly as, over the course of the 11th and 12th centuries, European Jews were excluded from almost any other line of work. This in turn made it harder to contain the practice, as witnessed in the common joke, current in 12th century ghettos, to justify usury between Jews. It consisted, it is said, of reciting Deuteronomy 23:20 in interrogative tones to make it mean the opposite of its obvious sense. Unto a foreigner thou mayest lend upon usury, but unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon usury. On the Christian side, in 1140 AD, the exception of St. Ambrose found its way into Gratian's Decretum, which came to be considered the definitive collection of canon law. At the time, economic life fell very much under the jurisdiction of the Church. While that might appear to leave Jews safely outside the system, in reality matters were more complicated. For one thing, while both Jews and Gentiles would occasionally attempt to make recourse to the exception, the prevailing opinion was that it only really applied to Saracens or others with whom Christendom was literally at war. After all, Jews and Christians lived in the same towns and villages. If one were to concede that the exception allowed Jews and Christians the right to lend to each other at interest, it would also mean they had the right to murder one another. No one really wanted to say that. On the other hand, real relations between Christians and Jews often did seem to skate perilously close to this unfortunate ideal, though obviously the actual murder apart from mere economic aggression, was all on one side. In part, this was due to the habit of Christian princes of exploiting, for their own purposes, the fact that Jews did sit slightly outside the system. Many encouraged Jews to operate as moneylenders under their protection, simply because they also knew that protection could be withdrawn at any time. The kings of England were notorious in this regard. They insisted that Jews be excluded from merchant and craft guilds, but granted them the right to charge extravagant rates of interest, backing up the loans by the full force of law. Debtors in medieval England were regularly thrown into prisons until their families settled with the creditor. Yet the same regularly happened to the Jews themselves. In 1220 AD, for example, King John ordered a tallage, or emergency levy, to pay for his wars in France and Ireland. According to one contemporary chronicler, all the Jews throughout England of both sexes were seized, imprisoned, and tortured severely, in order to do the king's will with their money. Most who were put to torture offered all they had and more. But on that occasion, one particularly wealthy merchant, a certain Abraham of Bristol, whom the king decided owed him 10,000 marks of silver, a sum equivalent to about a sixth of John's total annual revenue, became famous for holding out. The king therefore ordered that one of his molars be pulled out daily until he paid. After seven had been extracted, Abraham finally gave in. John's successor, Henry III, 1216 to 1272 AD, was in the habit of turning over Jewish victims to his brother, the Earl of Cornwall, so that, as another chronicler put it, those whom one brother had flayed, the other might embowel. Such stories about the extraction of Jewish teeth, skin, and intestines are, I think, important to bear in mind when thinking about Shakespeare's imaginary Merchant of Venice demanding his pound of flesh. It all seems to have been a bit of a guilty projection of terrors, that Jews had never really visited upon Christians, but that had been directed the other way round. The terror inflicted by kings carried in it a peculiar element of identification. The persecutions and appropriations were an extension of the logic whereby kings effectively treated debts owed to Jews as ultimately owed to themselves, even setting up a branch of the treasury, the Exchequer of the Jews, to manage them. This was, of course, much in keeping with the popular English impression of their kings as themselves a group of rapacious Norman foreigners. But it also gave the kings the opportunity to periodically play the populist card, dramatically snubbing or humiliating their Jewish financiers, turning a blind eye or even encouraging pogroms by townsfolk who chose to take the exception of St. Ambrose literally and treat moneylenders as enemies of Christ who could be murdered in cold blood.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it due to time. If you hear of any harsh measures being taken against bankers, such as restrictions on bonuses or stock options, that's somebody's fevered attempt to play the populist card, I suspect. Even if members from Goldman Sachs go to the wall, it could be infighting. I guess it could be both. I'm going to refuse to be impressed until the entire system is changed, which I don't think will happen top-down. I think it'll happen bottom-up, from people deciding they have better things to do with their lives than pursue money or listen to people who come asking for it. If you like this show, it's available for download from our webpage, as are all previous episodes from the archive, unwelcomeguest.net/archive. If you have a comment relevant to just this episode, you can enter it in unwelcomeguest.net/611. The music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I appreciate all your comments and follow them up, and that's what helps me make this show what it is. Keep following your heart, not with the brave men. They'll take your money.